This week on Out in the Air, our entire show features artist, author, glassworks creator, Linda Ponwall Carlson, discussing her creative journey influenced by her artist parents who ran John Ponwall Film Company in Chicago, producing old school animation. Our spotlights Memorial Opera House grand reopening production with Mel Brooks' musical Young Frankenstein opening September 26th.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art in the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Memorial Opera House, and she's going to tell us all about what's going on there. It's a great season coming up, and they're going to get back into the building. We can talk a little bit about the renovation process. Adrienne Vansmer, and she's the events coordinator there. Welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Hi, thank you for having me back.
Yeah, it's nice seeing you.
Nice seeing you guys, too.
Well, Adrienne, I guess first off, just tell us a little bit what the update is on the Opera House getting back to normal operation and what your first show is going to be.
Our first show will be Young Frankenstein. So that's our first full theater show after renovations. It's going to be on stage September 26th through October 13th. If anybody doesn't know anything about Young Frankenstein, it's a Mel Brooks production and is just absolutely hysterical. And it's great because it's basically a musical comedy, add some songs that, you know, putting on the Ritz that some people will be really, really, you know, excited. They're like, I know that song, but we got some surprises in for that show too. So there's going to be some cool technical surprises and some exciting things with that show. And I have seen some of the rehearsals and some of the auditions, and we have an amazing cast for the show. So we cannot wait to get up on that stage.
You can't miss with Mel Brooks. I mean, I saw your production of The Producers a few years ago, and yeah, Mel Brooks is just it's this winning combination and everything like that.
Absolutely. If you don't go out of there laughing like crazy, we did something wrong for sure.
So after that, what else do you have going on?
We have our annual Phantoms of the Opera House, and this year it's going to be a band called Electro Retro. That'll be Saturday, October 26th, and that's at the Porter County Expo Center. Just a fun night, dancing.
Costumes.
Costumes, for sure, arts and crafts, food trucks. It's a great, fun event, too, and that is a 100% benefit for the Memorial Opera House Foundation. And then the weekend after that, we have Michael McDermott coming back with Michael McDermott and the Arsonist. That's Saturday, November 2nd at 7:30 p.m. And then the next weekend, directly after that, Saturday, November 9th, is the Ultimate Doors. They're an ultimate tribute band. The Doors, they do, you know, pretty much everything Jim Morrison you can think of. So down the line. So another great, fun event that's going to be a great show as well.
So are tickets available for those now, or is it closer to?
Tickets are available for everything now through the end of the year at memorialoperahouse.com.
And you have some combinations of, you know, discounts, like you can combine things into a season. Can you explain that process?
Yeah. So we have a couple of different things. So you can buy season passes, which gets you, you know, you get to mix and match, but that is just for the theater productions, not necessarily the concerts. And then there's also a flex pass option. Those flex passes you can buy, you know, however many seats you want and for however many shows, and you can pretty much just mix and match it throughout the entire season. So yeah, some great other options available. And then we also do, you know, military, student, and senior citizen discounts as well. So if it's just a single show you want to come see, you know, give us a call or log in and we can get you set up for all of that.
Get those tickets early.
Absolutely.
Well, we will do an interview about Scrooge, but are you having auditions yet for that?
Scrooged auditions are getting ready to, I think that they will be Scrooged auditions. September 9th will be Scrooge audition. Yep. So they can go online on all of that on our website as well. And they can either, you know, put in the application or they can actually submit video auditions as well. So if they're not able to make it to our in-person auditions, we do take video auditions now as well.
Excellent. So tell us about on the ground renovations. What does it look like?
It's going to be amazing. You know, all new seating, all new paint, carpet. It's just a beautiful, fresh look to the theater. You know, we're excited to watch everybody's faces as they walk in the door. It's going to be a little bit different, a lot more open, a lot more room to mix and mingle before the shows and during, you know, our intermission. So it's going to be a neat. So please come out and see what all the fuss has been about and why our doors have been closed for the last, you know, few months, because we had some exciting changes inside.
Well, and you've done some stuff in the interim. You know, you just finished not too long ago in August, High School Musical Junior, which you were doing at Hebron. So, you know, it's not like the Opera House, like if the facility shut down, but you were doing different things.
Absolutely. We were still moving and grooving and keeping on with all of the rest of the things that we've done. So just because our doors were closed doesn't mean that we weren't, you know, doing productions, you know, Penguin Project, all of those rehearsals, all of that kind of stuff, even though not in our regular space, have been moving and keeping up. So we're still as busy as we were before, just, you know, not there yet, but we'll be hopefully
spread out.
We're ready.
So for 2025, any peek on what's happening there yet? Just kind of a preview?
No. 2025 right now is pretty much under wraps. We will have the Penguin Players Cabaret, which is another division of our Penguin Project. And then our first event of the year is, you know, Mega Beatles that we always start out with, which will be January 18th.
So hit again for Young Frankenstein, which is the focus of this interview, is about dates, times, tickets, information, and everything like that.
Yep. Young Frankenstein is September 26th and runs through October 13th. Tickets are available online right now.
And that's at the Memorial Opera House right there in downtown Valparaiso. You can find out more information online at memorialoperahouse.com. And that's Adrienne Bansamer, who's the events coordinator there. Thank you so much for sharing all the information about what's coming up at the Memorial Opera House.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I'll keep you guys updated with new as we get there.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And a spotlight extra. Lakeshore Public Media's newest multimedia project, Building Blocks, premieres its six-part TV docuseries that takes a deep dive into the science of early childhood development during a VIP breakfast launch on Wednesday, September 25th at the Dean and Barbara White Community Center in Merrillville. Get your tickets now at lakeshorepublicmedia.org/tickets. Traditional photographer Tim Lace and fresco artist Diane Grams discussing their Chesterton Art Center exhibit, Gods and Warriors, in September.
There have been movies and other photographers have done it, but I felt like mine are a little special. I initially showed them to Hannah Somm. I initially showed them to Dan Breen from Panoply. They all sort of sat in my hard drive and on a shelf, and I really didn't. I was printing them occasionally, but I didn't. I saw it as a show, but I really didn't throw it all together. But then Hannah said, "You know, you kind of got something here. Let's do something." So that's how it all came to fruition.
So one of the stories that I learned when, and this is in my article that I won an award for, was just the fact that, you know, a lot of the Native Americans were moved from wherever they were, and they did go through New Orleans, and some of the people I interviewed were Choctaw, and when they were being moved to Oklahoma, they just said, no, we're not Indian, we're Black. And in their words, it says, no, we're Black, we're staying. And so this whole thing of like the Black and the Indians together really represents freedom for them in this particular culture. It's a way to come out and just be something absolutely spectacular. And I just loved it. But then when Tim was taking these pictures, he got so much stuff that I never got I was shooting video with a camcorder mostly, and I would take pictures, but I wasn't getting the detail that he is. So they're very beautiful in detail.
So tell us the process of how you talked briefly about showing your work to Hannah, then Diane, you also, and how that came together as an exhibit.
Well, we proposed it to her when she became the director, and we wanted to both do a show. And so he's going to be in the front part of the gallery at the center, and I'm going to be in the back. And it's really kind of two separate exhibits, but we're saying because we both worked on each other's exhibit, it is a collaboration. But mine is I'm really looking at the place of fresco in Indiana, because what I loved about when I first learned fresco, I thought I had to get all the stuff from Italy. And then I learned actually maybe about 15 years ago that I could just get lime from Indiana. And so that's really it's really about a love letter to Indiana. My frescoes are this beauty of the state and the limestone and this stone that, you know, makes these government buildings. I mean, a lot of the Washington Monument and the Empire State Building is made from Indiana limestone. And the fresco is, you know, this burnt limestone inside, which became a very beautiful plaster.
In our last few moments here, we're going to give you a chance to talk about the dates of the exhibit, everything and opening celebration.
So the show, the opening, the Friday, the reception is September 20th from 4 to 7. The show will be up from September 6th through October 30th. It's a 2-month show. But the reception is September 20th, 4 to 7. We have an artist talk, which we're both going to walk you through our various exhibitions on September 28th, which is a Saturday, from noon to 1. And then on October 19th at noon, I'm going to be doing a fresco demonstration to show that, you know, this beautiful putty is so different from what you can buy at today. You know, the mud that's used on drywall, it's nothing like the material that I use for fresco. So I'm going to do a little demonstration. And all these are free. And so we really would hope that people would come out to the Chesterton Arts Center.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. That Tim Lace, photography and paintings by Diane Graham of Giants and Warriors. It'll run September 6th through October 30th with a reception on the third Friday, September 20th at 4 to 7 p.m. Tim and Diane, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air and sharing.
Yeah, thank you. It was so interesting.
Thank you for having me again and us together. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by McCauley Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Did you know that you can also listen to Art on the Air anytime as a podcast at Lakeshore Public Media's website, through Lakeshore's app, or from NPR? Plus, it's available on demand from your favorite podcast website, including TuneIn, Spotify, Amazon Music, Pandora, Apple Music, iHeartRadio, and many more. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode.
Hi, this is singer-songwriter Kenny White, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome the magical Linda Pownell Carson to Art on the Air. Linda is an artist, mother, and author, among so many other subtle and creative endeavors. She began her artistic journey at a young age, having two artists for parents. John and Jean Pownell had a successful commercial and glamour photography business in Chicago, with her father branching out into directing TV commercials and even making his own feature-length film. In 1973, while in pre-production on his second film and about ready to start filming, he was murdered. 51 years later, his murder is still unsolved. A book has been completed, and hopes for a publisher and a film are in the future. In 2017, Linda's book, Cordwood on Sunnyside, debut detailing her family's unique experiences creating their home. 2017 was also when Linda came across a historic grain elevator and decided to embark on its restoration. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Linda. It is terrific seeing you. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for that very nice introduction.
Well, we're so glad to have you on the show, Linda. And one of the things our audiences all want to know is about our guests, and they call it their origin story. And I say, how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about Linda.
Well, like Esther mentioned, I was born to some very creative parents. My mom and dad, Jean and John Pownell, met at RIT while going to school there. My mother was a sculptor and my father was a photographer. They decided that they wanted to have a commercial studio. And in that decision, they had several choices to make on where to move, because Sanford, Maine was definitely not the place to start that kind of business. And neither was Rochester, New York at the time. So they chose Chicago. I grew up in Chicago. I love Chicago. It's like my hometown. I was there about 2 weeks ago and I saw old girlfriends. And it's in my heart. Chicago will always be in my heart. My parents, their first studio was on LaSalle Street, and my brother and I were so blessed with the people that they rented from. Rosa Dooley is how I remember the name of the woman that they rented from, and I have forgotten her husband's name because she was more important to me at that young age of, 2 to 6 or something of that sort. So she was a ceramics artist. So not only did my brother and I have a chance to make mud pies, we also had a chance to create a ceramic artwork, because Rosa was more like a grandparent to us and was kind in her kind with her time and her teaching with her experience in clay. Besides having that experience, because the studio was part of the attachment about where we lived in the house, we used to have these 12-foot rolls of paper that were pulled down for sets to have a neutral background. And when they were dirtied a little, my brother and I got our crayons out, and we were able to draw over this 12-foot area of paper. And I loved it. I spent hours and hours doing that. It was like the greatest babysitter in the world for my
parents. Oh, my gosh, probably. Total freedom.
So my parents were very ambitious. My father was very, loving, very outgoing. My mother was outgoing in a different way, and they made a great couple. You know, I can't imagine like going to a new city, having dreams, and then fulfilling those dreams with their ambition and their desires. From there, my parents bought a building on 918 West Armitage. And it was an old building. I remember going up when I was a kid. It was a 3-story brick building. And we went up all the way to the 3rd floor. And, I don't know how old I was, maybe 7. But I remember it was dark. The person was old. And the room was full of smoke. You know, it was just really grungy. It was so different from where we were living on LaSalle Street. My parents bought that building. And I don't know how they magically transported that space into a beautiful living space with, open light color walls and refinished floors for the family. And then the next part was the first floor that became the studio that they worked out and were very successful with. You know, my father had dreams of making television commercials. And he needed a space that would permit that in 2 different ways. He needed a large space, for pictures, like that 12 foot piece of paper, right? For backgrounds. I mean, I remember one time they brought a horse in and there was a model laying on the back of a horse. Oh. And the horse was white and the model had this long, black, straight, beautiful hair. And she put her head by the where the tail was, and her hair fell down with the horse's hair. And it was a nude, My parents did photographs for Playboy. But it was such a beautiful, beautiful memory and vision. You know, they my parents had a studio that operated for making commercials. They also did on locations. There was a dark room downstairs, an editing room. The first editing room was on the first floor. And then they had the ability to shoot into the studio. So they had a screen so that they could show their work, you know, because you have to promote your commercials. You have to promote whatever it is that you're trying to sell or get the next job. You want people to see what you can do. They later did the second floor, and the second floor was for entertaining and bringing advertisement people into the building. And they dined them and wined them. And that floor was filled with Herman Miller furniture because, yes, they did commercials for Herman Miller, you know. And so I think part of the payment must have been, you know, that 10-foot round Herman Miller table and couches and all the rest of the little side things. So that set an image in my mind as a child on how things looked and what people did, which at that point I did not realize the impact that had. You know, as a child, you'd understand that that might be a little unusual. I'm glad everybody did that.
You're absorbing it, but you don't have the context.
Right. You don't have the contents. So from there, my parents, they were ambitious. And for about 10 years, of all of the 60s, they made commercials. On the 70s, my father started doing little shorts, and he made his first feature film, which was called Goodbye, Fat Larry. And it was about a girl that was tired with the mundane life in Chicago and found it very unfulfilling. You know, there was what more is there to life than going to work, doing the normal things? So she decided that she would rent a Hertz truck, put her belongings in the truck, and travel west and see what happened. That movie was completed, but was never released. I still have a work print of it. And, you know, I would love to see something happen with my father's artwork.
Wow. I think that's really possible. Linda, I want to know how this artistic environment was so rich with images. And I mean, just these two aesthetics of these two people you were living with. So how did your school life, I mean, how can it even equal that? I mean, the education you were getting at home was like fabulous, but how did your school life integrate into all of this? What were you doing in school? Did they have an art department that could even come close to what you were learning at home?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, I used to like to write words and then make those words disappear into images. And so my father would, he set me up, you know, taking a picture of each thing that I drew, right, and adding it together. And then after the words were written, then I started taking pictures of how they developed into, you know, imaginary drawings, right, abstract drawings. I don't know how a school system could compete with that kind of education. You know, it's like I made a little cartoon that was a you know, film. So, you know, school could not compete with what I was learning at home as far as art was concerned.
So how were you expressing yourself in school?
School was difficult for me because I was very artistic, but felt very lacking in my ability to express myself through words, or I did like math. So school was not something that was easy for me. I didn't feel, you know, I didn't feel well set into that framework.
That's understandable. So you're still in Chicago and your parents. So what happened after your father did that first film?
Well, when he did the first film and the commercial business was not being focused on. So he had nine people working for him. He had, you know, people editing, an electrician, you know, a secretary, accountants, you know, people to help run the complexity of a business, somebody that worked in the dark room. We actually had maids to keep that three-story building clean because, you know, it's a big responsibility to keep it looking appropriate for people to come into. So after he finished that movie, there was a couple things that happened. The business, the commercial, he was losing his interest in doing commercials and he wanted to make another film. And as children for, I don't know, maybe for 5 years, we had gone to Maine every summer. My grandmother lived in Maine and they ended up buying a cottage that was built by my great grandfather. So we would go and spend the whole summer in Maine on a, you know, on a sandy beach in front of, it was called Square Pond, a small lake. And it was a lovely life. It was the perfect mix. Chicago in the school year and, you know, Maine with the sunny beaches and, you know, your friends, like my girlfriend would come to Maine with me and we'd hang out all summer long. That was a beautiful life. One summer, 1971, we never came back home to Chicago. I was 13, going to be 14. And that meant losing my best friend, Donna, who I just saw like 2 weeks ago. We're still friends. I love her. She's, and I have that connection with her. And I still have this connection with her when I see her 50 years later. But at that time, in 71, we didn't have cell phones. You know, there was no Zoom meetings happening.
No emailing.
No emailing, right. So the ability to communicate on a personal level was very limited. So I felt, I was angry at that point. I had to go to a new school where people knew each other for a long time because it was a small town. So that was a very difficult transition. It wasn't just difficult for myself. It was difficult for my brothers. My brother seemed to blend in well, but my parents, that was not an easy transition for them. They were used to Chicago. They were used to living this life of, entertaining and
prominence.
Right. But they made a decision to move to Maine. My dad was held up at gunpoint that year. And the business was, he had to do some serious work to help the commercial business get back on its feet after taking off so long to make the movie. So they decided to change course, move to Maine, find somebody that was interested in running a movie company, because my father saw that Portland, Maine would probably house that kind of thing. New York City wasn't that far away, so they could, they were using film back then too. It wasn't digital. It's, another big thing to think about, how are you going to get your film developed? All those little particulars that are very important for the 1970s. So we did the transition. I stayed a crazy mad teenager. And my father started about a year later, setting up a gentleman with the film company, and his name was Joseph Castellucci. So after setting Joe up, my parents knew how to do this part because they had made a movie, and they knew that they did not want to be running the financial side and paying the bills and also doing the creative storytelling part of making a movie. Joe seemed to like the idea, was interested in doing the job, so he spoke of, but that soon turned into he wasn't doing his job. He was supposed to be raising money. They had, in the summer of 1973, seven kids on a Treasure Island. There was a girls' camp. The seven kids were learning how to do their lines, row kayaks, do different, probably skiing, just do different things that kids would do so they could shoot the film. And my father was engaged with those children every day. We worked with them for a couple months during that summer. And things were going along on the creative end. Gene Shepherd was writing the play, the screenplay for the Salem 6 movie. The kids were working and developing their skills, but Joe wasn't raising the money. And so things were not getting paid, and my father was beginning to realize that he was going to have to go out and do that part of the job, which he had an appointment with somebody that was going to invest in the movie. This is when things became disturbing. I was not there during the summer. I had my aunt and uncle lived in Mexico City, and I had gone to Mexico City. And of course, the only courses that I took were art courses in Mexico City. I should have taken one Spanish course, you know. But you know, being a kid with little direction, or maybe not able to listen well, only took 3 art courses. It was a great experience. Once again, you know, exposing myself to where my talents lie. But when I came home in August, my mom picked me up. We came to the office where Planet 3 Films was, and there was a discussion going on that was not pleasant. There were loud voices arguing and people pounding on the table, and you know, and this was such a different aspect of how my life was. We didn't have that. You know, my parents, they might have a argument, but it wasn't brutal. They came to closure with their discussions on their, what they thought. This was totally different. This was disturbing. And in that evening, there was a gentleman that came up to the office where, the front office where I was sitting. And he tried to make some little chit-chat with me. I immediately did not like this man. I did not know who he was. He had a plaid suit on, but he seemed very creepy to me. And this was Herbert Schwartz. And he is, I believe he is the reason why my father is not here anymore. Between that evening, they were trying to get my father to sign a director's life insurance policy, which was for $400,000. They wanted my mom to be on the policy, and there was discussions of her not being on the policy. And that was part of the argument of that evening. The insurance policy was signed later. I think it was like the next day. And 10 days later, my father was murdered. This was, you know, I was...
It's just impossible.
You know, it's hard to believe. 50 years later, you feel that pain in the heart. But we're not going to go too deep into that because it's a little depressing. And, you know, all these different parts of your life add up to make who you are later in life. The men that killed my father went to trial and they were acquitted. And I don't want anyone to be confused that acquitted means that you're innocent. You know, when I hear people say, oh, they're innocent. No, they were acquitted. The information wasn't brought in properly so the jury could hear it and then decide on it properly.
Right.
For me?
When this happened, you were just like 16 years old, right?
I was 16 years old.
So during the trial, how old were you?
There were 3 trials. They lasted 5 years, so up to 21. And it was extremely difficult to live through those trials and see the justice system not work, you know, and have hope that it would work.
Did your family hold together at this time, or?
When my dad was murdered, I did not want to live in that house any longer. I was daddy's little girl. My mom and I, you know, sometimes women have little conflicts.
You know? So, mothers and daughters.
Mothers and daughters. So we had that mothers and daughters relationship that had a little type of conflict. So I just wanted to not be in that house. So I actually got an apartment, lived on my own, finished my senior year of high school. My dad's case is on the news, in the paper, every day. And I went to my high school reunion, which was, I can't believe 50 years at this point.
It goes fast.
This year. And it was interesting that people came up to me and spoke to me about that, you know, about what happened to my dad. I had three people come up and reach out to me.
And that wasn't happening at the time, probably because everybody said you needed your space or something.
Yeah, it wasn't. Well, because you don't know how to speak to somebody that has gone through a tragedy like that. What do you say to them? And when they say something to you, how do you respond? You know, a lot of times I actually avoided that question, like, if, you know, in conversation, well, you know, where are your parents? What happened to them? I would just say he died. I wouldn't use, because as soon as I said that my father was murdered, there was always this silence of uncomfort, you know. And what I have learned is that that's not good for the person experiencing that to keep that to themselves. It's not my fault that it happened. I shouldn't have to cover it up, because covering it up just adds another layer of burying that very sad moment.
Right. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM on WVLP 103.1 FM with Kalinda Pownell Carson. I know, to keep it all bottled in just makes it worse.
Right. And then I also think about, look at how many people have gone through what I went through. There are so many people that have had their loved ones killed and there's no justice. And there's not really a lot of communication on that to this day, 50 years later.
You know, I want to take you back a little bit in your father's history and his portfolio. We sort of glossed over that a little bit. But some of the early photography did for, well, clients like McDonald's, Wishbone Salad Dressing. So tell us a little bit about that period, including Playboy. So tell us about some of the photography, and then we'll jump back ahead.
Okay. So one of the commercials that stick in my mind was a Chrysler commercial that my father did. And they wanted somebody, I've read on an article, crazy enough to do this ad, where they took a Chrysler up over the city of Chicago, you know, dangling from a helicopter. There was needed two helicopters, my dad dangling from one, shooting film, okay? And that's not a little camera. That's a big camera. And then, and they only had one chance at this. They only had one chance. They needed the image to be right. They dropped the Chrysler into a cornfield. And I don't remember. All I remember is a picture of the car hanging from a helicopter and then being dropped. So, I mean, that was a great commercial. Now, I wish I had that commercial. I you know, it's possible I might have it. I have some things down in my basement, but I don't have the ability to see them because it film. I've done the best I can to keep the film in the right kind of temperature, but you know, it deteriorates. So you might only have one chance to like look at it before it falls apart. In my, you know, he did McDonald's posters and commercials and Playboy. And so my brother was 2 years younger than me, and I'll tell you a little story. And there was always a lot of pretty attractive women in the studio. And oh, my younger brother, he just loved women. Do you mean, even at his young age, he was like, and they loved him because he was cute. You know what I mean? So he got attention from pretty women and he ate it up. Well, we also knew that my dad was going to take pictures of these women nude. And my brother was like, Linda, let's go look through the keyhole. So we would go downstairs and, you know, hope that, you know, my brother especially, hope that we could see one of the models, you know, laying on this or doing that. Do you mean? Hugh Hefner was over at times. I didn't know who he was. But, you know, they were engaged in marketing, and they did a great job with marketing. Would you like to know something else that I'm not hitting upon?
Oh, sure. No, I think it was interesting. That kind of builds on the background of the film and everything like that, but the commercial work that he did. And of course, when you went to Maine, it's, you know, in Chicago, you're kind of in the center of a synergy that does that. And being out in the Maine, it doesn't seem like that move. Maybe your parents were tired of maybe the involvement in Chicago. And so, but I mean, Maine doesn't seem like the place where you continue doing as much of that type of stuff.
Yeah, no horses coming into the living room with.
No. Yeah, it was a huge transition. I mean, my uncle lived in Mexico City. And so I know that they planned on having two bases, one in Maine and one in Mexico. My father wanted to continue making movies. That was his next thing he was going to do. So he made one movie. He was in the process of making a second movie. You know, I know that he had thoughts of a third idea, but I'm not sure what that is. I couldn't share that with you. The Salem Six was about not six kids, seven kids, because there was one tag along, one little one that tagged along. And the children wanted to protect their land. They were noticing that wherever they were hanging out in this little river-like area close to the ocean, that there were things that were dying and things were not, the water wasn't as clear. They noticed the pollution coming from a factory. And so they wanted to stop the factory from polluting their area. And so it's humorous and serious all at the same time, and giving a message of our environment in the 70s. So his concepts were very advanced for the times. And, you know, I can only imagine what he would have brought to our world at this point.
So consequently, your own, you said you moved into your own apartment. How does your art career develop? What are you working on artistically at this point?
Well, at this
juggling
point,
juggling all these emotions.
Oh, you mean when I was younger? When I was younger, it's just, you know,
like after high school sort of time.
Right. So after high school, it was a survival. Do you mean how do I have an apartment and pay for it? How do I eat? You know, I remember I was getting Social Security benefits, but here's another thing. The company, the film company, didn't pay into Social Security from my father's paycheck that he got from the company. And hence, I didn't really have much to live on from Social Security, even though I was going to school. As long as you're going to school, you could collect, you know, X amount of dollars from Social Security at the time. So I had to figure out how to make money, how to pay for my apartment, and go to school. So there wasn't much time, there wasn't much availability to do artwork. I always had a pen and paper. I had a little book that I would draw in. And so that was my artistic,
release.
That was my artistic relief at that time. Yes. Yeah. So for years I wasn't, you know, that was 5 years of just existing, you know, make money, try not to be, I was finding the wrong ways to relieve my stress and my depression of what was occurring. And after the trials, my mom moved back to her hometown in Rochester, and she took my two brothers. She wanted me to come with her, but I did not want to go. So I stayed in the Maine or New Hampshire area for a while. I did want to continue with college, and you know, with the schedule of like having an apartment and working, I wasn't able to go full time. So I would take several courses. I went to Portland Gorham. I went to the University of New Hampshire, but I never matriculated to any school. And I did. My mom finally did talk me into. She said, "Well, why don't you come to Rochester, and I'll pay for you to go to RIT."
Oh, well,
well, that didn't happen. What happened?
The ultimate carrot.
Yeah, the ultimate carrot. Here's a little carrot for you, girl. But what she really meant was the third trial was fighting over the money, the life insurance money. And my mom had to settle. They settled out of court. Casalucci was denied. And I think they paid off. I think they probably paid off Schwartz. But the insurance companies don't have to let that information go. I know that they tried to settle with my mom, Casalucci and Schwartz, for $475,000, and my mom would not go with that settlement because she didn't want to settle with the murderers of my father.
Right.
So she ended up getting walking away with $20,000. Yeah. And so she gave, since I was living on my own, she gave
another crime.
Another crime. Yes, another crime.
And so now you're in New York.
Now I'm in New York, the place I said, Mom, I will never move to New York. Because I don't like the taxes here, even back in the 70s. Well, guess what? That didn't work so well. So here I am, you know, 2024, living in New York, in beautiful Canandaigua. I ended up going to Nazareth, and I didn't finish school there. I was a fine arts major, studying, working with metals and casting and welding metals. So that was where I moved into the 3D world. I really liked the 3D world of art. And I didn't meet my husband then, but at that point I had made a wine chalice. And it had two silver figurines in dance, and I raised a silver bowl, and I entered that into the class art display, and I thought I put a really ridiculous price on it. It was like $400 or $500, and to my surprise, it sold, and I didn't even sign it. and I couldn't find out whoever bought it. So that was not information that was given to me. Even though I tried to receive that information. It was years later that I met Kurt, because I still wanted to finish this wine glass. And I think it's much sweeter to put your lips on glass than it is to sip from metal. So I was introduced to Kurt through a friend, and we started making all sorts of artwork at that point. I would go, he was working for another glass blower. We would go and he would make bowls and I would draw on them with cane. And so this is how our relationship started with going into the art world that I so love.
Mm-hmm. Collaborating.
Yes, I love to collaborate.
So tell us
and
more.
Go ahead, Larry.
So tell us more about the creations that you did. You were kind of at the beginning of the story, but you then formed a glassworks. And tell us about some of the things that you did create during that period.
That's really big because, you know, she's got the glass and then they're building a home. And all of this is kind of happening all at the same time. And it's, you know, and your resilience comes through.
I must love a challenge, apparently. So Kurt was working for a glass blower, and we had access to his studio, which there's a lot of equipment in glass blowing. You need a furnace, you need annealers, you know, you need torches, and then you need, you know, grinding wheels, and, you know, you need a lot of equipment, sandblasters. So we worked out of, we start our business working out of Bill Glassner's studio. And of course, you know, we wanted our own studio. So Kurt had some land in Middlesex, and we ended up building a studio there and living in his trailer there. I fit a trailer and we built a studio because it was hard working out of the trailer. I did my paintings out of the trailer at first, you know, in the front little office area. It was pretty crowded. And at that point, we also did not want to live in a trailer. So we built a cordwood house. We had been looking at alternative buildings, you know, building underground. And one of the underground homes, because I liked how it was efficient. You actually stabilized the temperature of the house and you didn't have to actually heat it much or cool it much if it was partly burned. So we saw this house that was had a cordwood front, and it was a very intriguing look because it looks like stone from far away, but actually it's the It is the log ends that you're seeing. And the logs are 18 inches in length, and they're built with concrete all the way around them. So there's like 5 inches of concrete on the outer edge and 5 inches of concrete on the inner edge. And in the middle, it's sawdust and lime. So we designed and built a cordwood house. Kurt worked with Bill. We, you know, did the extra work of, you know, still trying to make artwork and finishing artwork and getting the artwork out there. We started doing art shows, local ones first. Bill would go to wholesale shows. So that was something that we were exposed to, doing wholesale shows for our galleries. And that opened our eyes to another way of marketing the art glass. And I don't know what year we started doing gallery work, but that was a very good way to broaden our market throughout the United States. So we started selling all over the United States and going to high-end art shows where I met you, Esther.
Yeah. That wonderful day.
You're listening to our guest today, Linda Ponwell Carlson, on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. Well, currently, you did glasswork for some time and everything, but maybe in our last few moments here, tell us a little bit about some of the other creative things you've been doing maybe in recent times or since the glassworks. I know that you stopped doing glassworks, so I understand. So tell us a little bit about that story.
Right. So the artwork that Kurt and I created needed both of us to create that particular style of artwork. And in 2017, we separated. So that ended the career of Carlson Glassworks and that particular style of art. You know, we created beautiful artwork. It had multi dimensions of depth to it. You know, we had created a piece that was called A Man Woman. So one side was a female face and the other side was a male face. And then there was a dancer inside where you could look into the artwork. And that was to represent our work together as artists. Because when you're working as an artist together, it takes a little tangle to do the work. You know, you have to trust the other person to do the best they can. And hopefully their vision merges with yours, which is different than what you would do. So there's a lot of trust involved in that. So after that period of time, I came across an old building, a grain elevator. It was abandoned. And I thought it would be a great idea to buy an abandoned grain elevator.
Because you had nothing else to do.
Because I had nothing else to do. And but, you know, there it shows how the connection back to my parents when they bought the building on 918 West Armitage. You know, that was a building that needed to be totally redone. So I was able to see a vision in that building and to throw myself into developing it as a living space. So right now I have a rental. It is a it's a midterm rental. And my daughter has moved in with me. She lives on the second floor. I live on the first floor. And it's a beautiful, circle coming back again.
So where are you on the grain elevator?
Right now, I am on the first floor. And I do have, I have to finish the fourth and the fifth floor. And there's one room on the second floor that is it's where I have my chop saw and all my tools to work on the rest of the building. So I'm handy. You know, being a 3D artist, I've learned how to work with multiple materials and understand them. And I love to make things.
Right. Yeah, you built the cordwood house.
I built the cordwood house.
Your hands.
Yeah, my hands, right. And I love creating things that are three-dimensional that, are welcoming to people.
Functional and beautiful.
Yeah, functional and beautiful.
Well, in our final minute here, I want you to share where people can actually see some of the glasswork and how they can reach out and find out more about you. I think there's a, and I don't know if this site's still active, the AmericanCraftsman.com, where they have some of your glasswork. But tell us a little about how that in our last moments here.
Yeah, so I have American Craftsman has all of the Carlson Glasswork's art that's available for sale at this point. He has both galleries in New York City and in the Berkshires. So he's the person to contact if you want some Carlson Glassworks. There's not much of it left. You know, it's a limited supply of beautiful work.
Beautiful work.
Limited edition. Well, Linda, that's Linda Ponwell Carlson. Thank you so much for sharing your art journey, your whole history with our audience. We really appreciate you coming on Art of the Year and doing so. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for talking about your father.
Well,
it's good seeing you.
Nice to see you again also.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker, and for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art on the Air. We rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know. Esther and Larry, Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.